In partnership with the Community of Scholars Program at the University of Minnesota, this episode is a contribution to SPARC, a digital open access multimodal platform where COS scholars graft engaging stories about their research.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very good evening from Friday. Your captain, my name is Bodil Wish, and welcome on board our beautiful Boeing 787 10 series, the Dreamliner. We are almost ready for departure. However, one of our passengers drank too much alcohol. I had to deny him to board the aircraft. He was too drunk. And for security reasons, I have to offload his luggage. So we are waiting for the bag to be found. The ground staff is working on that right now. As soon as the hatches are closed, we will fly towards Amsterdam with a flying time tonight of 7 hours. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're comfortable in your seats, and I do wish you a very pleasant flight.
It's December 12th, 2020, and I'm leaving Dubai to return home to Alton, Illinois. I'm glad it wasn't me this time, I said to myself as I giggled about the intoxicated man asked to leave the plane. That's when I removed my journal from my bag and placed it in the seat compartment in front of me. I wanted it handy once airborne because part of my flight routine is making time for reflection. I've been an avid journal writer since the age of 12, and when I'm high in the sky, I get the perfect view of God's Matchbox car set. You know those car sets that children play with? They set up whole towns with cars and trees and buildings. From the sky, that's what the world looks like to me. God's Matchbox car set. Writing in my journal while looking down at that view makes reflection feel like a grounding mantra to express gratitude for my life experiences. Today, gratitude is for the Sheikh Saud bin Sakur Al-Qassimi Foundation for Policy and Research. I planted that thought in my mind and planned to come back to it after I got settled. I removed my shoes and placed them under my bag on the floor. Since my body is aging, feet swelling is an issue that I have to prepare for long flights like this. Today I have 3 layovers. Dubai to Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Detroit, Michigan, and Detroit to St. Louis, Missouri, a total of 27 hours. And when I land in St. Louis, I'm going to quarantine in a hotel for a week. This virus is real. And with all of this international travel, I need to take extra precaution before I see my family. As the flight safety video began to play, my mind drifted back to memories of South Africa, the impetus for this nomadic lifestyle of mine. I was 20 years old when I left America for the first time. Actually, study abroad impacted the trajectory of my career as an international teacher. I was a junior in university at the time, and what was supposed to be a 6-week program examining the vital role of education in South Africa turned out to be a trip that changed my life. During the entire 6 weeks, schools were closed and teachers were out in the streets protesting. Civil servants were demanding a 12% pay increase and better resourced schools and refused to go back to work until the government compromised. I still remember those broadcasts on South African news channels.
Industrial chaos in South Africa as unions take to the streets to mount the biggest strike in decades. So what happened to the dreams of black workers freed from the tyranny of apartheid as the color drained away from the promise of the Rainbow Nation? This is Inside Story.
There is no doubt the civil servant strike significantly impacted my study abroad experience. But what was even more significant was the vast reshaping of my identity. As an African American in South Africa, there were so many contradictions. With my micro braids and blending skin tone, at first glance, folks didn't even realize I was American. Conversations initiated by South Africans in Zulu is what blew my cover. When I talked, my flat English accent revealed that I was a guest in their country. I didn't belong there. And being with a group of study abroad students, majority of who were white, blew my cover too. But honestly, I had no idea that there were worlds outside of America where the default was black. Black folks on billboards, black folks on food and hair products, black folks in high professional positions, black folks on money, all those black civil servants protesting in the streets. In America, I was taught to believe that being black meant being a minority, but South Africa flipped that thought right on its head. When I returned to the States after that trip, I say I kind of fell into the teaching profession. I actually wanted to join the Peace Corps and get back out in the world. But eventually, that's where I went, right into the classroom. What I found out quickly, though, was the 5 years that I spent gaining my bachelor's degree in early childhood studies and that study abroad experience wasn't enough to prepare me for the 2 years I spent teaching in Illinois. Understanding pedagogy and philosophy, how to create a lesson plan, and even how to assess student outcomes provided no prerequisite knowledge for how to be a black teacher at an all-white school. That's why I left the position and I left the profession. And I'm not the only one who left. Many African-American teachers leave. But see, I don't care to understand notions of teacher shortage. My research is about developing questions to understand why African-American teachers choose to leave the U.S. PK-12 system for teaching opportunities abroad. That's what drove me back to the UAE, to interview African-American teachers and find out why they chose to leave the U.S. This question is directly connected to my personal experience, and it's also connected to the long history of teacher attrition for African-American teachers. See, Beverly Cole said that in 1950, half of all black professionals in America were teachers, compared to less than a quarter of white professionals. Scholars also say that before the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court case, approximately 82,000 African-American teachers were responsible for educating the nation's 2 million African-American public school students. A decade later, over 38,000 black teachers and administrators lost their jobs. Between 1975 and 1985, the number of black students majoring in education declined by 66%, and another nearly 22,000 black teachers lost their jobs between 1984 and 1989. Linda C. Tillman said, as black segregated schools closed, black students integrated into white schools, but for various reasons, black teachers did not. And the unintended consequence of Brown was that thousands of black teachers lost their jobs. So in 1986, when Beverly Cole said black teachers were an endangered species and at risk of being eliminated from the school systems in this country, she was right. According to statistics from the 2017-18 school year, of the 3.8 million U.S. teachers, African-American teachers only represent 250,000. And when compared to our other marginalized counterparts, while Asian and Hispanic teachers continue to increase in representation and proportion, African Americans continue to decrease and have decreased from 8.2% to 6.7%. Teaching is an interesting profession, particularly for black teachers in America. Salary increases are important, but in my opinion, there isn't enough conversation being had about teacher identity. There are severe intersectional components of being a black teacher in America. Even now, nearly 14 years after my study abroad experience, after teaching in Casablanca, Morocco, and in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, and even with travel to over 36 countries, I continue to tell myself, my career as a teacher didn't begin until I left America. The sound from the loud, roaring aircraft engines interrupted my thoughts and brought me back to my flight. It's time for takeoff. Once airborne, I reached for my journal and began to write. December 12, 2020, 2:53 a.m., I wrote. I'm finally on my way home after 14 months in Ras El Khaimah. Even though I spend a significant amount of time outside of America, I always return home. It's like I've created normalcy living in a state of temporariness. A bit of time here, a bit of time there. That's how I've spent my entire adult life. It's funny because when people describe me as an expatriate, I try to resist it and instead embody the stance of James Baldwin. He is known as a black expatriate. Yet, What many people don't realize about him is that he never claimed to be an expatriate. He was very adamant that he was not expatriating America. With consistent commutes over the Atlantic Ocean, back and forth between America and countries like France and Turkey, he described himself as a transatlantic commuter. This commute from the UAE back to America makes me realize the parallels between my life and the life of James Baldwin. I've become what I like to describe as a transnational commuter. Same genre, but different generation. And in addition to the Atlantic Ocean, my commutes have also spanned across other oceans and seas. I remember reading a 1970 interview with James Baldwin in Essence magazine. He talked about how Paris had little to do with his decision to leave America. Oh, wait, I think I have it on a file in my phone. Oh, here it is. Let me write this in my journal. He said, "I didn't come to Paris in 48. I simply left America. I would have gone to Tokyo. I would have gone to Israel. I would have gone anywhere. I was getting out of America. Here, I was in danger of death. But in America, it was not a danger. It was a certainty. Not just a physical death. I mean real death. The death of working in the post office for 37 years, of being a civil servant for a hostile government, the death of going under and watching your family go under." Ooh, even as I write those words, I feel butterflies in my stomach. James Baldwin's words are so meaningful to me because the trajectory of my career as a U.S. teacher was sure to be that type of real death. I wonder if other American teachers feel that way. Like, we enter the education system with passion and aspiration for education. We believe we're educating the nation's most valuable commodity, the youth. But the price of teaching is that you're constantly grinded down by a system infested with institutionalized racism, capitalistic practices, and disposability politics that create a lack of care for teachers. There's a hidden expectation that I'm supposed to sacrifice my life for 35 years, and then only in retirement I can actually start living. I didn't want that. I wanted to teach. I wanted to be able to show up in a classroom with autonomy and as my full self and just teach. Me leaving was my personal fight against racism and the undervalue of not only American teachers in general, but Black teachers in particular. When I went to Morocco in 2011, I finally felt what it feels like to be an American. It's like I had access to a type of psychological freedom, and my thoughts about race and class and gender and nationality were simply for comparisons. Comparisons between my life in the U.S. and my life abroad. For me, being a Black American abroad is much easier than being a Black American in America. In Morocco, my Black vernacular English was never corrected. Children who were different from me actually wanted to learn from me. The parents of these children didn't question my expertise because of my race. It was like I finally had the opportunity to teach. I always say, with my time abroad, I had the privilege to be taught by 5 and 6 year olds. I was awakened by the over-illumination of the cabin lights. I noticed my journal in the seat compartment in front of me. I guess I managed to place it there before I dozed off while writing in my journal. A flight attendant announced that we were preparing to descend, so I grabbed for my shoes and put them back on. I had a short amount of time between this flight and the next. I've been to Schiphol Airport many times, so first, I need to find a restroom, and then I'll find my boarding gate. I arrived at the gate area and spotted a set of empty seats off to the back. The seat I had my eye on faced the open window, a good view of the guys loading luggage and stocking the plane with essentials. The amount of effort that goes into providing comfort and safety on airplanes always amazes me. I was sitting there for about 15 minutes when a random man approached me. I could tell he was American by his American accent. He said, "Excuse me, are you Tiffany?" Now, I knew I didn't know him, and I was surprised that he recognized me with my mask on. "Yes," I said. "This is going to sound awkward, but my wife is hiking in Ras Al Khaimah with a friend of yours. My wife told me to look for you in Dubai because she knew we were on the same flight. Now, she did tell me that you were African-American, and when I saw you sitting over here, I figured I'd ask if you were Tiffany." I giggled. Of course I giggled. Right before I turned around and took a glimpse of the other folks in the gate area. He was right. Of the nearly 100 folks sitting around, I was the only Black person. We began chatting, and I was very surprised to find out that he works for an elite family in the UAE. Equestrian club, training horses for horse races. He mentioned that he and his family had been in the UAE for nearly 20 years, and although several times they thought about returning to the States, they never had. I boarded the aircraft and found my seat. His seat was further back in the plane, so he and I split ways. Once seated, I started thinking about the plethora of opportunities that the UAE has to offer. Who would have thought that someone could make a salary training horses in the UAE? I guess it's the same for schools, though. A result of the globalization of education is the substantial increase of English medium international schools. These schools not only provided me with an opportunity to teach abroad, but also the teachers that I interviewed in my study. See, in English medium international schools, the curriculum is delivered in English, but the school is outside of an English-speaking country. The schools, they offer an English medium curriculum, which is different from the country's national curriculum. The best way I describe these types of schools is, imagine a school in the US or in the UK. Pick it up and drop it down in another country. Expatriate teachers hired to work in these schools are oftentimes from countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, countries in Europe, Australia, and primarily other countries from the global north. Many of the students in these schools are children of expatriate parents working for multinational businesses, government officials with an embassy or a consulate, or children of well-to-do local national families. Most interesting about these schools is that the market is booming. Approximately 6 million students across the globe attend schools like this. And the revenue? These schools produce a revenue of nearly $54 billion in fee income. There are discussions that can be had about the problematic impact that these schools place on particular societies globally. But there is no doubt that the market is growing. In the year 2000, there were approximately 2,500 English medium international schools. And in the year 2020, there was nearly 11,500. In 2018, China ranked first as the top 10 leading countries in possession of the most English medium international schools. And of course, the UAE ranked second. This is why my dissertation research uses the UAE as a case study. In 2010, when the educational reform urged that each school in the UAE have an internationally accredited teaching staff, thousands of teachers from Western countries migrated to the UAE to fill these positions. And I'm not talking about private schools. Private schools are usually tuition-based and for-profit institutions. I'm talking about government schools, like public schools that local national students attend for free or at a low cost. But schools, whether government or private schools, are not a significant factor for the retention of some African-American teachers in the UAE. When I interviewed many of the life historians in my study, for them, societal factors had a much more viable role in why they chose to remain there. Yes, on the one hand, teaching opportunities at such schools can be viewed as a pull factor that attracted folks to the UAE. But on the other hand, schools play a small role in what motivates them to stay. For instance, in an interview with Camille, a selected pseudonym, she has spent nearly 7 years in the UAE. When I asked her what made her remain there for such a long time, she said, "I like the way of living here, to be honest. Safety is priority, especially in the last 4 years with everything happening and the attack on African Americans in the U.S. I feel safe here, and I don't feel the pressure that I felt at home.
On behalf of all of us at Delta, welcome aboard. If it's been a while since you've flown, rest assured, your comfort and safety are still our number one priority. At every step of your journey, you'll experience the Delta care.
See, it's this notion of safety in the UAE. That's a recurring theme that came up in several of my interviews. Safety is also significant for me because it's one of the reasons that my stay was prolonged in the UAE. When I arrived to the UAE in September 2019, I was scheduled to return to the US in May 2020. Yet when COVID-19 hit and the borders began closing, flights back to America became limited. By the time May came around, I became fearful for my safety. I was literally scared to return to the U.S. The global response toward the ill treatment of Black men and Black women in the U.S. and in other countries spread across the world stage, and I was witnessing it all from the UAE. The images of protests revolving around the public murder of George Floyd made me worry, not only for my family and not only for my own safety, but mostly for my friends in Minneapolis. Overnight, the city had burst into flames.
In addition to examining the project, CBCF connects members of Congress to enact real, life-changing legislation that uplifts our families and our communities. Today's call is entitled A Double Pandemic. While tragic, I can't think of a more fitting title for this conversation because it was.
See, when people began describing the pandemic as a double pandemic, the widespread of the virus COVID-19 and the global fight against white supremacy, for African American expats, we understand this differently. Marilene Shane describes it best in her article, The Black Expat Living Abroad as Your Country Burns. She also lived in the UAE for nearly 7 years. In her article, she wrote,
being an expat unable to come home to the States due partly to COVID-19 and job obligations, it's even harder to watch from the sidelines. You know, you're feeling torn between being thankful for the blessing of where you are, and you have the fire inside of you to get engaged in the fight firsthand. You watch as you see protests carried out on television that you know you would be a part of if only you were there.
A friend of mine describes Marilene's feelings as survivor's guilt, possessing a sense of happiness for not being directly in the trauma, while also possessing a sense of guilt for having survived it. This sense of duality not only touches on the myriad of factors contributing to why some African American expats left America, it also touches on why they choose to stay in the UAE.
Welcome aboard and thanks for flying with Delta. Our first priority on every flight is the safety of our customers and crew. So before we depart, please pay attention to this important safety message. Be sure that all carry items are securely stowed in an overhead bin.
It was finally time for the last leg of my long series of flights. Detroit, Michigan to St. Louis, Missouri. I'm almost home, I thought to myself as I boarded the plane. I sat down and thought, with the large amount of sleep I got from the previous two flights, there is no way I'm going to sleep on this one. So as the safety video began to play, I grabbed from my bag and removed my iPhone. To make time pass, I decided to listen to an episode of my podcast, Abroad in Education. When I finally created this podcast in January 2018, it was an idea that I had been sitting on for at least a year. I was scared to put my voice out in the world, scared that folks wouldn't even be interested in what I had to say. Oh yeah, it was that course I took with Dr. Barbara Kapler, Dynamics of Intercultural Communication and Education. In that class, I learned about intercultural communication, which Stella Ting Toomey says is about the study of cultural differences that really make a difference in intercultural encounters. My integration project for the course was the idea about the podcast. And you know, since then, the 53 episodes have been downloaded over 7,500 times in over 80 countries. See, the mission of Abroad in Education is to discover roots through conscious conversations about EDPATs, which are expatriates working in education in schools outside of their home countries. Now, when I say roots, I don't mean R-O-O-T-S. I mean roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. Pathways, mobility, whether social mobility, economic mobility, generational mobility, and even geographic mobility. There's something significant about the vast shifts that occur through intercultural encounters. My vision for the podcast, in the spirit of bell hooks, is to decolonize imaginations through migration stories from diverse educators. See, I'm reminded about this article written by Andrea Collier, why telling our own story is so powerful for Black Americans. She writes about the imperative need for Black folks to tell our own stories, how Black Americans come from a long lineage of storytellers. And not only is it our purpose to tell our own stories, but also for other folks to bear witness to our stories. See, in each of the episodes, it's an attempt to grapple with folks about their intersectional identities and how those identities inform their decision to migrate and engage internationally. But like Andrea Collier alluded to, it's also to hand the mic over to folks for them to tell their own stories. Like Leslie Rebecca Bloom and Petra Monroe said, these folks are life historians who are choosing to narrate the intimate details of their own lives. The complexity between my research and this podcast is that oftentimes I don't know where one stops and the other begins. From these attrition and migration stories, I learned that the decision for some Black American teachers to leave the U.S. is highly influenced by intersectional components, neatly wrapped up in their comparisons between their lived experience in the U.S. and their lived experiences abroad. For instance, the episode I'm listening to now, episode 46, with John David Lewis, we're discussing his chapter in the book called Going Global. He talks about his motivation for moving to the UAE. After attaining a degree in higher education, progressing in the U.S. education profession, and even opening up his own business in the U.S., he said,
it's a different level of appreciation. I mean, we lived in a high rise on the beach.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's no way I could have afforded that in the United States. I had, like, a 3,500 square foot flat in a high rise on the beach. And I'm thinking, like, this is, like, some rich people stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't responsible for that. And I was like, I did all this in the States to come over here to find the American dream.
That you can, you know,
following and performing the societal script doesn't always guarantee success, which is what makes stories like John's even more complex. And, you know, that's the point that I've been trying to get across in this episode. There is a dire need for Black American teachers to tell their attrition stories, for teachers in the UAE and other countries abroad, for them to tell their migration stories, why they chose to leave. And educational leaders, policymakers, and even scholars in academia, we need to bear witness to these stories because it's one of the few ways that we can identify and address the complex issues within the U.S. education system. Too many conversations about educational issues focus solely on the student. But my question is, what about the teachers? Where are the teacher-centered conversations being had? With a final descent, I was relieved when I landed at Lambert Airport. Lord, thank you for your traveling grace to St. Louis, Missouri. A silent prayer, I thought to myself. After I deboarded the plane, I quickly headed to the baggage carousel to collect my bags. My 250-pounders were still intact, another relief. I learned a long time ago, to receive your bags back in the same condition they were in when you checked them is a miracle. Missing wheels, broken straps, scratches on the surface. Yep, I know all about that. Even the instances when I found that little note from TSA informing me that one of their staff members rambled through my luggage while I wasn't looking, I don't even mind that anymore. This is travel. These are the hidden parts of the itinerary. With both of my bags in tow, I removed my phone from my purse and ordered an Uber. My reservations are at the last hotel. It's supposed to be a posh and comfy type of place. And with a name like that, the last hotel, there has to be something special about it. Especially since I'm going to be staying there for a whole week. When the Uber driver arrived, he didn't even offer to help me put my luggage in the car.
The hospitality that I had been accustomed to, literally a little over 24 hours ago, was now gone. I'm back home in America. The Uber driver and I got in the car in silence, and he drove me to my hotel. During the short commute, the word that came to my mind was layovers. There's something significant about layovers, I thought. My route, my itinerary from Dubai to Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Detroit, and Detroit to St. Louis, Missouri, even with an arrival, my journey is not finished. Being here in the States is a layover, you know? Like a space of being between one's departure and one's arrival. Like you're on the route, you're on the right path, but you're not quite there yet. Discovering Roots, the title of this episode, reveals another layover. There will be another departure, another arrival, another itinerary, another journey. This is the epitome of research. Asking questions, not only on a quest for answers, but also on a quest to discover the root of how one arrives at an answer. Be sure to share this episode.
Abroad Education is created by Tiffany Lachelle Smith. Lady Justice, the song that you're listening to, was written and produced by Rillionaire Dreams. You can get his Postcards album on SoundCloud. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you download your favorite podcast. Let's keep the conversation going and follow me on Instagram at abroad_in_ed. And you can also access the website at abroadineducation.com.